This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, France hunts for another fugitive linked to the Paris attacks. Media experts assess the coverage.
One thing that strikes me is the fact that left-leaning, right-leaning papers are quite united in terms of not trying to make some political recuperations right now, at least we're still in the aftermath.
Many Syrians at risk of life-threatening illnesses. Hollywood reacts to the latest terrorism. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. French officials say they are seeking a second unidentified fugitive following last Friday's deadly Paris attacks. Officials said an analysis of the series of attacks indicated one person directly involved was unaccounted for. Seven attackers died that night, three around the National Stadium, three inside a Bataclan concert venue, and one at a restaurant nearby during attacks that killed 129 people and wounded more than 300 others. French and Belgian authorities have issued a warrant for one person, Salah Abdeslam, whose brother was among the attackers. Ending a brief visit to Paris on Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the Islamic State group will feel even greater pressure in the coming weeks following their claim of responsibility. He met with President François Hollande and discussed ways their governments can be more effective in battling the Islamic State group. Media coverage of the Paris attacks was the focus of this week's hashtag VOA TV program, which was broadcast Tuesday. VOA's Michael Lippin hosted the show, which discussed how traditional and social media have responded to the terrorist assault.
One expert whom I spoke to is Gene Polosinski. He is the chief operating officer of the Newseum Institute here in Washington and also a veteran journalist who specializes in free speech issues. Here's what he had to say about coverage of the Paris attacks by the big U.S. news organizations.
Well, I know there are critics who say that it's gotten a lot more attention than some other incidents around the world because it's Western-focused. I think there's certainly a part of it where Western media can identify themselves with being in Paris and the Western society as opposed to Bangladeshi bloggers who in a series of attacks have been hacked. And there was an attack on a convoy with media in East Africa. But also, I think they've discovered to go where the media is. You know, the media was on the ground there, instantly coverable.
You don't think that was a coincidence?
I don't think that was a coincidence. I think it was a very strong strategy to say, how do we get that maximum impact? I don't think ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or any of the rest are going to give up attacks in areas that are remote. But I think they've seen now, and they've demonstrated, and they're learning. Part of the chess moves, you put your piece where the maximum attention will be. And that was in Paris, where media was already there. Social media, just huge in France. Instantly and very quick response from traditional media because you're already on the ground. So I think that we're seeing this chess match play out, and that's one of the reasons traditional media was there in such numbers and with such intense coverage right away.
And are the traditional media aware that they might be playing into the hands of the attackers by just giving so much coverage to them?
You know, I think that's a good question, and I think, again, hopefully people both in social media and in traditional media are learning that they're now not just covering a story. They're becoming used and utilized by these groups. And I think that requires some strategy, and it's been done in other ways. I think that social media has responded to the postings of ISIS and others in ways, and taking down sites and blocking things. I think we've seen traditional media realize that part of the tactic here is to scare the largest number of people, to frighten the largest number of people as quickly as possible. We're seeing that happen.
Well, that's the view of the media from here in the States. I also spoke via Skype video in the program to a freelance journalist in Paris, Clea Broadhurst. She was on the streets shortly after the attacks began on Friday night. I asked her whether the attacks have led to the French media expressing a rise in nationalistic sentiment or political point scoring, what the French call récupération.
One thing that strikes me is the fact that left-leaning, right-leaning papers are quite united in terms of not trying to make some political recuperations right now, at least we're still in the aftermath. I mean, we'll see in the coming weeks because we have regional elections. So we'll see what happens then. But right now it's more trying to, you know, make sense of what happened and try to answer some questions, and not only for a political party or for some people in particular. It's the whole media have decided to stand together and show that.
Well, you can hear more of our conversation about the media's response to the Paris attacks by going to our hashtag VOA Facebook page and watching the show right there on Facebook.
VOA's Michael Lippin, host of hashtag VOA. The head of Russia's security service says last month's deadly plane crash in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula was a terrorist act and that explosives were found on the debris from the aircraft. The security service chief says the blast came from an improvised explosive device. A $50 million reward for information leading to the arrest of those responsible is being offered. Militants with links to the Islamic State say they carried out the attack. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy talked with three analysts about the air disaster. International edition Susan Yaki spoke with him about what he found out.
John Brennan, CIA director, says that the crash bears the hallmark of the Islamic State terrorism.
Well, according to Peter Bergen, director of National Security Studies at the New America Foundation, an Egyptian militant group who pledged allegiance to the Islamic State claimed the responsibility of downing the airliner, exploiting the poor security measures at the airport.
Now, I've talked to British officials who said when they did an assessment of the airport security at Sharm el-Sheikh, where after all thousands of their citizens go every year on holiday, they found it to be inconsistent, poorly supervised. So this was sort of a target of opportunity.
Bergen said the local group is following the same model of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, operating on behalf of Al-Qaeda Central.
Then which will be the responsible culprit, the Islamic State group or the Sinai group?
Well, so Michelle Dunn, director of Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, argued that the terrorist act was carried by a local insurgency that used the Islamic State just as a supporter.
I don't think it's right to look at what's going on in Egypt and perhaps this terror attack as being an outgrowth necessarily of what's happening in Syria, for example. They are almost all Egyptians. There are very, very few foreign fighters.
Dunn said the rising number of Bedouins in Sinai flocking to join the so-called Sinai Province group can be traced to the massive human rights abuse of the Sinai citizens, let alone the socio-economic factor.
Now what happens in Russia?
According to Maxim Trodolyubov, a Russian senior fellow at the Wilson Center, the investigation outcome would be a wake-up call to the aftermath of the Russian military involvement in Syria.
It's bringing in the cost of what Russia has been doing in the Middle East. So far, it's been really a television campaign. People are watching TV and they're watching Russian planes, fly in a very spectacular fashion, something that's actually never been shown on TV before. This acquires a completely different dimension for the Russians.
Maxim said with the conclusion that it was an act of terror, Russian President Putin will be in a very tough position because he has to respond in a very powerful way to killing over 200 Russians in that terrorist attack.
VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. Russian President Vladimir Putin vowed vengeance against those who carried out the attack. He did not specifically blame Islamic State for downing the Metrojet A321 aircraft, killing all 224 aboard, but within hours launched an aerial bombardment on Raqqa, the Islamic State's self-described capital in northern Syria. Egyptian officials say they have yet to reach a conclusion. They've shifted their focus away from the cause of the crash to speculation on what they consider a Western conspiracy against their country and the severe impact the crash is having on its key tourism industry. President Obama pledged Tuesday to help Asia-Pacific allies boost their maritime security as part of talks with leaders in the Philippine capital, Manila. The White House announced a package of up to $250 million in new aid over the course of 2 years, including $79 million for the Philippines, $40 million for Vietnam, $21 million for Indonesia, and $2.5 million for Malaysia. Mr. Obama is visiting Asia for two summits, the two-day Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, gathering in Manila, which gets underway today, and the East Asia meeting scheduled later in the week in Kuala Lumpur. Meetings with allies and heads of state of the participating nations in the just-concluded Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact, the TPP, are expected to highlight his visit to the Philippines. Mark Beeson, a professor of political science and international relations at the University of Western Australia, told International Edition's Victor Beatty that while the TPP could be a dominant issue in Manila, it actually underscores the failure of APEC to achieve what it was created for in 1990, trade liberalization.
There's always a big question mark about implementation, particularly in Southeast Asia, because Southeast Asia's also got its own economic cooperation initiatives, the Asia Economic Cooperation area, and there's some question about how successful that's going to be. There's some question about how easily they will be able to implement some of the quite far-reaching proposals that have been made in association with things like the TPP in particular. So there's always a big gap between rhetoric and reality in Southeast Asia in particular.
Aside from the APEC meeting in Manila, there is also going to be a East Asia summit in Kuala Lumpur. In Manila, Philippine officials have indicated that the South China Sea tensions will not be discussed directly by the APEC members, but there could be discussions on the sidelines.
When APEC was established, there was no expectation that it was going to be primarily a sort of leaders forum in which non-trade issues would actually be discussed. It had a fairly limited agenda, and it's been a product of contingent circumstances to some extent, I think, in the fact that some leaders have wanted to use it to promote other kinds of agendas and other issues that have come up in the interim. So I can understand why some APEC officials in particular might want to try and keep the agenda focused on trade issues. But when you get an organization where some of the world's and the region's in particular most important leaders turn up and there is a chance to discuss important issues of mutual concern, you can understand why that might take priority over what can sometimes be fairly arcane trade issues that don't really capture the same kind of importance.
Well, the President of the United States is in the Philippines even as both countries forge closer defense ties.
And that's going to make things a little bit complicated because clearly the U.S. and the Philippines in particular are very concerned about the so-called rise of China and China's territorial ambitions in the region, which have had a big impact on the Philippines. And the Philippines has tried to reinvigorate its security relationship with the United States, and the United States has been fairly happy to oblige in that regard. So there are a number of things going on in the strategic arena which are going to make isolating or discussing easily those kinds of trade issues much more difficult because they are sort of technocratic and technical issues in many ways, but they're going to be overshadowed, I think, by these bigger geopolitical concerns and developments that have been happening, not just in Southeast Asia, of course, but in Europe as well. And I think it's going to be difficult to maintain the focus exclusively on issues to do with the Asia-Pacific at this particular get-together as a consequence.
That's Professor Mark Beeson of the University of Western Australia, who also says while the Philippines is trying to keep South China Sea tensions with China off the agenda, the impact of the Obama administration's stated intention of rebalancing toward the Asia-Pacific region has been limited by events in the Middle East and Europe. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Coming up, a growing disease threat in Syria. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Loud snoring is not just a problem for those who hear it. Snoring can cause sleep apnea and serious health effects for the snorer. While simple lifestyle changes can help, a San Francisco company has a more high-tech solution for snorers called Smart Nora. It's a bedside monitor that senses when snoring begins and wirelessly activates a pump to inflate a mat beneath the snorer's pillow, altering his head position. Behrouz Hariri is co-founder of Smart Nora.
Nora is actually listening for volumes of snoring that are below the sensitivity of their partner. So just before snoring is getting loud enough to wake them up, Nora does the gentle push or the gentle movement
The Mayo Clinic says about half of adults snore and suggests some simple snoring solutions such as losing weight, sleeping on your side, and avoiding alcohol before bedtime. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition. The World Health Organization warns that hundreds of thousands of people in Syria are at risk of life-threatening illnesses this winter because the country's broken health system is ill-equipped to care for them. Lisa Schlein has details from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Before the war, Syria had a well-functioning health system that kept illnesses in check. But now, 5 years into the conflict, Syria's healthcare system is in shambles. The World Health Organization reports nearly 60% of the country's public hospitals are either partially functioning or closed. And the same situation is true for half of all primary health care centers. WHO's representative in Syria, Elizabeth Hoff, says conditions in the still-functioning health facilities will get worse as winter sets in. She says these facilities have problems with electricity and water supplies. Few hospitals have generators that work, and fuel is in short supply.
And I would say that the most serious situation is, of course, the threat of communicable diseases. But as we are moving out of the hot season and into the cold season, we have more problems vis-a-vis respiratory illnesses, particularly in children and elderly, and the influenza. So we are trying to make influenza vaccines available to the most vulnerable groups.
Hoff says it is extremely difficult to operate in a conflict situation like Syria. She says it is almost impossible to gain access to millions of people in need. She notes 3.2 million people live in hard-to-reach areas, and about 350,000 are living in besieged areas. She says it is particularly difficult to have access to some 1.7 million people living in areas under the control of the so-called Islamic State.
Access is the principal concern, not only to reach with supplies, but also for patients to reach the health services and for health workers to reach their workplace. So this is not only in these hard-to-reach areas, but it's also difficult even in Aleppo City, in the western part, which is controlled by the government.
Hoff says communicable and chronic diseases are not the only concerns. Every month, she says, more than 25,000 people are newly wounded in the war and need trauma care. Unfortunately, few surgical supplies are available. On a more positive note, Hoff says a cholera outbreak in Iraq has not yet spread into Syria, and national polio vaccination campaigns have succeeded in keeping that crippling disease at bay. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turning now to the world of social media. Some characters upstage the gathering of world leaders, and there's a big announcement from the world's largest chain of fast food restaurants. Here's International Edition's G. Abby Lee with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray.
So what's the first story about today?
It has to do with something that happened during the G20 summit in Turkey. If you ever thought no one can steal the thunder from Presidents Obama or Putin, you might want to think again. One of the trending videos on Facebook is about three unannounced guests making an appearance at the G20 summit. They are three stray cats casually frolicking around the main stage before the world leaders took to the stage. They ran across the stage and quite literally smelled the roses and left. My favorite post is from NPR, the National Public Radio. It wrote, "Did they come to stage a coup? Hard to say."
Well, they might have been part of the security detail. Don't really know. But moving on to the fast food story, what's the latest on that?
McDonald's announced it's getting rid of the uber-popular dollar menu. What it is a collection of items that cost $1 each. Instead, they're rolling out a McPick 2 menu. The new menu starts on January 4th. With that, customers get to pick a pair of items for a total of $2 from four choices, including two sandwiches, a small order of French fries, and mozzarella sticks. NBC News posted its report on the announcement and asked, "Should McDonald's ditch the $1 menu?" The first comment reads like this: "If they take the dollar menu off and only make a two-for-two menu, then the ones who used to spend just a dollar would now be forced to spend $2, which means more money, a dollar at a time." Another comment that got the most number of likes, by the way, reads like this. How about good prices on something healthy?
Well, when you go to McDonald's, you really can't expect to eat anything healthy. That's
Absolutely.
Part of the fun of going to McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like some people are seeing it as a rather clever business strategy, while mm-hmm. others are still asking for healthier options.
Exactly. And the company has been making that effort in the past decade. They introduced salads back in 2005 and started serving all-day breakfast last month. Now, if you ask me, those options are not technically healthier, but at least it gives off the impression of being so. Times are changing even for such an iconic fast food chain. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GIBLEY. That's JEEABLEYLEE. Or on our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. The Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year is not even a word. It's an emoji, officially called the Face with Tears of Joy emoji. It was chosen because it best reflected the ethos, mood, and preoccupations of 2015. According to Oxford Dictionaries, an emoji is a small digital image or icon used to express an idea or emotion in electronic communication. The word is Japanese in origin. The entertainment industry is reacting to the terrorist attacks in Paris. Several music and cultural events were canceled. Some of Hollywood's stars are also commenting on the tragedy. International Edition's David Byrd has more.
Jane Fonda calls Paris her second home. The 77-year-old two-time Academy Award winner, who is generating more Oscar buzz for her role in the film Youth, says that she is concerned the attack will make life even more difficult for refugees seeking asylum in Europe.
I have family there, so the first thing I had to do was find out if everybody was okay. You know, my heart just breaks for refugees because it's going to be so much harder now. I mean, it's hard to imagine things could be harder for the refugees, but it's going to become more difficult.
Rachel Weisz, Fonda's co-star in Youth, says that the attacks are a terrible tragedy, something that the whole world feels.
Well, I mean, it's a very hard thing to talk about. Like, I guess all I can really say is it's just an absolutely incredibly terrible tragedy, and my heart goes out to the victims and their families, and just our, you know, I think everyone on planet Earth, our thoughts and our thoughts are with those people. It's a terrible tragedy.
Christian Bale stars in the new film The Big Short, about four outsiders in the world of high finance who predicted the credit and housing bubble of the mid-2000s and decide to take on the big banks for their greed. He says the Paris attacks call for wise leadership and compassion.
It's unbelievable. It's horrifying. And just a desire to somehow let people in Paris know that, you know, the world is standing with them and feels united with them in this unbearable grief. And, you know, man, do we ever need, you know, wise elders to kind of guide us through this and tell us how to respond.
Jeffrey Wright, who plays Papa in the new Disney Pixar animated film The Good Dinosaur, says that the attacks on Paris, because of its status as a world cultural center, are an attack on all of humanity.
I just want to express a sense of solidarity with the people there, and also just express the need as well for real strength right now for all of us, and working together to try to bring this to an end.
Veteran actor William Shatner says He doesn't understand how Islamic extremists hope to further their cause by killing innocent people.
If you shoot someone, even if I don't even know them, because you're trying to convince me that what you think is right, I don't know how that works. The only thing it arouses in me is fear and resentment, suspicion and distrust, and ultimately hate.
Several films have also altered or canceled their release plans. The terrorism-themed movie Made in France was scheduled for release November 18th, but that has been postponed. Monday night, cast members of the final Hunger Games film wore Mockingjay pins adorned with ribbons in the colors of the French flag at a subdued premiere in Los Angeles. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. More news, features, podcasts, and videos are available on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to six key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Obeida Diriye, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, Hassan Avguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Malim Salman and Ahmad Iman Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate Shopping Mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Obeida, also known as Diriye, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi O'Mohammed, otherwise known as Godanye. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations and the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmad Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.